certain version of the last meeting on.
The last version.
This is truly going to be the last meeting we have on insurance. And I'll give the floor to Andrea.
Okay, thank you. The papers for this meeting have all responded to issues that we have identified through the external editorial review that was conducted in December. We'll provide a bit more detail about that review in the APTC, but first we'll move straight to page 3 on that.
So paper 2A looks at how to treat some changes in the fulfillment cash flows and whether they should adjust the contractual service margin. And this is really revisiting some issues we discussed in November. So the changes that we're talking about in the first part of the paper are all under the general model, and they are changes that do not relate to financial risks. So we're talking about contracts under the general model and changes that arise because of changes in non-financial assumptions. So you'll remember that we have a general principle that changes that are related to future service, we take those and adjust the contractual service margin. Changes that are related to current or past service, we recognize immediately in profit or loss. We also say that in general, we would expect that experience adjustments are going to be related to current or past service, so will be recognized in profit or loss, and that generally changes in future cash flows relate to the future and will be recognized in the contractual service margin. In November, we discussed how to treat combined effects where you get an experience adjustment that directly causes a change in future cash flows. And we said, firstly, that we would want to combine those effects, and secondly, that we would recognize them in profit or loss. And we did this because we wanted to avoid situations where we would be getting a sort of grossing up of an effect, where we'd be recognizing a gain or loss for an experience adjustment, when there would be, in fact, an offsetting loss or gain arising in the future. And we wanted to avoid showing sort of grossing up of those offsetting gains and losses. The feedback that we got on that November decision was that, firstly, it was going to be operationally difficult to do that, because to combine those things, you have to identify which changes in future cash flows are caused by experience adjustments and which ones aren't. So you have to pick out the future cash flows that you're going to combine. We also got feedback that often this offsetting effect that we were trying to avoid being grossed up, but actually often the effect of the experience adjustment and the change in the future cash flows would actually go the same way. So there wouldn't be this offsetting that we thought was important to maintain. So question one of the paper 2A is asking you whether you agree with our recommendation that in fact we shouldn't combine the effect of experience adjustments and changes in future cash flows, because that removes the operational problems and it removes complexity from the standard. It makes it much simpler to express what we're doing. There's a greater chance that people will understand what it is we're trying to achieve. And in many cases, we don't need to try and avoid the problem that we had identified as being a problem because it doesn't exist. And I'll come on to, when we talk about question two, about how to deal with a common situation where that grossing up problem would exist, but we have a different solution for that common situation. So the first question is set out on page 8, and it's saying, do you agree essentially that we effectively take all changes in estimates of future cash flows to the CSM, combine some with an experience adjustment, and take it to profit or loss?
Yeah, I agree, and because mine in the session when we decided to combine the effect, I think I was convinced by the argument that it's always a net effect, which is offsetting, but obviously that is not the case. And secondly, I think I was convinced by your argument on paragraph 16 that it is operationally very difficult to distinguish between then changes in future cash flows which are caused by experience adjustments and which are not, and I think that is very, very difficult. And that is really more to the principle, and therefore I support this staff recommendation.
Amaro?
Thanks, Hans. Somewhat aligned with the comments made by Martin, making reference to our first decision. I think when we took the first decision, it was because we were convinced that that was possible to go ahead with these, I would call, challenge to separate, to split both components. But this is the result, and I'll say the benefit of having or being open to the feedback during the drafting process. I think this, I agree with the arguments put forward by the staff about the operational challenge on this, and I very much in agreement with the proposal.
Stephen.
So I agree as well. The problem for me is that I don't think there's a perfect solution to this, which is why we've had difficulty with it. And that's caused by the simplifications we've made in the past, so splitting experience adjustments and the adjustments or changes in estimates and putting the changes in estimates in CSM, and then also moving away from the unit of aggregation being the individual contract to the group. And those two decisions, my mind, have made this particular area impossible to get to the perfect answer. So inevitably there's going to be some compromise somewhere. And the bit that kind of doesn't work so well is the single premium contract, which is the one that we had in mind when we combined it in the first place. But then there were operational challenges with that, and the combination doesn't seem to work very well for premium contract because we haven't got the adjustment to the CSM at the individual contract level. So the whole thing has been a challenge, but for the various reasons that you give, including the operational thing, then I agree with the outcome that we've ended up with.
Errol.
I think I'm doing a little bit of a pile on here, following the same. So again, also agree with the staff, what staff have recommended we go with this. I think this is one of those issues where we, in November, tried to address a area of complexity that was raised by the testing through the testing process. I think in doing that, what we did was we tried to make it simpler. We tried to move it along a particular line. I think what we seem to have heard back through the editorial review is that people had both difficulty understanding where we were landing, and also I think had difficulty in figuring out the operational side of it. I think this answer, to Steve's point, is not going to be. But I think what it does do is provide a simple, easily understood approach to the way that you would do this. That helps us with the actual terminology, the actual writing, and the standard, and I think is going to help people understand it.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
All in favour.
Okay, so the next section of the paper looks at situation where you will in fact commonly get this grossing up of an offsetting loss or gain that we were trying to address in the November decisions, and that arises where you've got a delay or acceleration in repayments of the investment component. But we think that rather than trying to deal with that in trying to identify situations where you should combine things, we can deal with that by excluding investment components from the definition of an experience adjustment. So they never come into the assessment of whether you have an experience adjustment or not. And that means that you would get the effect of combining, you would get the offsetting effect that we want. And that's what question two is saying. Do you agree that we should exclude from experience adjustments investment components? And that means that effectively for investment components, we are sticking with the combined, treating the two things as a combined effect.
questions.
So I do agree, but I've got a question on paragraph 27, and particularly C, because I'd always thought that that wasn't actually an experience adjustment, it was just sort of a separate thing, that a change in the liability for incurred claims just automatically went to P&L. I'd never thought of it as an experience adjustment. I mean, I'm not saying that the accounting wrong, absolutely agree with it, but it's just from the point of view of trying to explain.
Yes. And it's we've always defined experience adjustments by looking at both the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for incurred claims, even though in fact you don't need to think about it for the liability for incurred claims, because all the changes in the liability for incurred claims go to P&L. So identifying two bits, both of which go to P&L, you know, you don't actually need to identify the two bits separately. And we have wondered whether it would be a simpler way of expressing things to, in fact, just have a definition of experience adjustment that relates to the liability for remaining coverage. And if we did that, then C would fall away, and we would be able, again, probably to streamline the drafting of the standard.
That's what I was thinking, because in C, you're splitting the change in liability for incurred claims effectively into two components, a change in the estimates and the difference between the cash flow in the period and the previous estimate of the cash flow. But you don't need to do that because they both go into the same place. So
that's right. Yes. Yes. I think it would be simpler, in fact, in drafting to make experience adjustments relate only to the liability of remaining coverage, and then we could lose C. And that, I think, would be a drafting improvement. Yeah.
Big one.
And a simple question, you see, you have insurance claims and expense, and B also have service expense. What's the difference
In C, we're talking about insurance claims and expenses. So the difference, B is drafted, the phrase insurance service expenses excludes the investment component. So if you think about a claim, it's got an expense element and it's got an investment component that doesn't form part of the expense. And so the way that we were drafting the experience adjustment, the point about B saying insurance service expenses, the aim of that is to exclude the investment component. Then in C, there we say claims and expenses incurred, and in fact that does include the investment component, but as we were saying, for the liability for incurred claims, it doesn't actually matter how we split these things up, because everything goes to profit or loss, so there isn't any danger of one bit including something that goes to P&L and another bit including something that goes to CSM. So if we can think of different ways of approaching this in drafting. I think the simplest would be to take out C completely and just have experience adjustments relating to the liability for remaining coverage, as Steve suggested. If we wanted to leave it in, we could make the wording of C consistent and just talk about insurance service expenses, or we could leave it as it is, and it would all come to the same answer, because everything on the liability for incurred claims goes to P&L. So it's really just a question of whatever is the easiest to follow when we do the drafting.
So if we were to set aside the drafting question, which is not something we want to do in the meeting as such, if we were to set the question to you about whether you want the effect of the investment component being excluded from the experience adjustment, could I ask a question on that basis? All in favour?
Okay.
All in favour?
So the next issue dealt with in paper 2A is the order in which we deal with changes to the contractual service margin. So what the second pre-ballot said was that you should make all your adjustments to the contractual service margin before you do the allocation of the contractual service margin to the coverage units in order to identify how much gets recognised in profit or loss as profit for the period. And we had feedback that that didn't seem to be appropriate if you have changes in assumptions that happen at the end of the period and therefore affect only future service. Why is it right to take some of the effect of that change and recognize it in the amount that you allocate to the current period? And we agree that if you set up particular examples and particular fact patterns, what IFRS 17 currently says can produce results that look anomalous. But that's really because the timing of the change in assumptions, I mean, it's the liability has to be measured at the end of the period, but the point at which that change in variables actually occurred, these are non-financial variables, so it's difficult to pinpoint exactly when that change will have happened. And it might have been at the end of the period, or it might have been at the beginning of the period. We're not asking people to be constantly remeasuring and releasing on a sort of constant remeasurement basis. So we have to make some sort of assumption about when the change happened and therefore what periods it should relate to. And we feel that measuring everything, including the service in the current period, using the most up-to-date information, although in some cases it gives, you know, an answer that looks quite odd. If you made the other assumption and you said, well, actually, we'll assume that everything happened at the end of the period, and we wouldn't take into account any of the changes in measuring the current period result, then in other cases that would give you anomalous results. So it is ultimately just a question of what simplification do we make. Whatever simplification we make is going to give odd results in one situation or another, and using the most up-to-date information seems to be the better simplification in the staff's view. So we are not recommending a change from the second pre-ballot draft on this issue.
Doc? Yes, I disagree with the staff's recommendation. The last time I agreed with you with the reason you just explained, we don't know when change happens. So therefore, it's a matter of decision. So I was happy with staff's proposal. However, after that, I found if we did it, it could cause maybe inconsistency in the model. It's a mechanical inconsistency. But let me explain. First of all, when we calculate revenue, we use the release amount of liability, fulfillment cash flow, based on the as expected amount. So it is written in the standard. So we should use the amount as expected. But when we calculate revenue, we add up the release amount of liability plus CSM. So if we use the CSM after adjustment, then we are adding up something inconsistent. So therefore, the number of the revenue could be the inconsistent amount. And the impact on the revenue wouldn't be that significant. However, when it comes to the net profit, it could be very significant. So in essence, what we are doing is we concentrate the effect of the change too much on the term it happened. So, it could cause a very odd outcome. So therefore, I disagree with it. Maybe in order to avoid such a situation, we may have two ways. One is we change the revenue calculation. So if we use the revenue amount after adjustment, then it's all just after adjustment basis. It would be consistent. However, I think it would be difficult because we have been doing the as expected basis so far. All of a sudden, if we change it, it causes unintended consequences. So then the choice is we should use CSM as expected, which is consistent with the revenue amount. So therefore, I disagree with the staff's recommendation.
Can I just say, if we did the revenue on the basis of what had actually happened, the consequence of that would be that experience adjustments would not be recognised in profit for the period in which they occurred. They'd end up in the CSM. And that's something that the board has consistently thought gives useful information, is recognising experience adjustments in the period that they happened. So it sort of sounds like a neat solution to say, oh, let's make everything consistent. Calculate the revenue based on what actually happened. But if you do that, the consequence is that you reverse a decision that you've stuck to on experience adjustments for a long time.
But actual payment itself goes to profit or loss anyway. And then the outcome reflects something what happened when you make a payment, the payout. When you calculate net income,
yes.
So I think having an inconsistent amount in the model would cause some unexpected things. That is my concern. I understand we would like to reflect the changes for the year, as many constituents are expecting. I understand the point. However, having the model, calculate inconsistent amount, is not really good, because this is the basic model. So therefore, I cannot say I'm 100% confident with the mechanics of the model. That's why I cannot agree with your recommendation.
Mary?
Two observations about this. In agreement with the staff recommendation not to make a change in the requirements that we have had in the document. A general observation about that is, at this point in the process of finalizing the standard, I think the hurdle for making any changes in decisions that we have worked through, that were part of the field testing, that was done, et cetera, It should be a very high hurdle to clear to say that a change is justified or necessary at this point. And I think the issue that we just discussed was basically us trying to respond in November to some things, and then thankfully getting some more feedback that broadened our perspective on the number of circumstances that had to be considered. So I think not making a lot of changes is the right starting presumption, and the staff analysis says to me that there's not a compelling argument to make a change in this area. That's one thing. The second is, and it's a follow-on that relates to one of the issues in the table in paper 2C, which is what do you do when you have changes in these estimates? Because I was just rereading this morning and realize that, let's say you have you follow the instructions in paragraph 28 for an interim period, and then you have the annual period. Are you saying how do you deal with the having made estimates to do the interim period reporting and estimates at the end of the year from the beginning of the year? And I don't think it's a problem with the staff's recommendation here. I think we just have to be clear about the interaction of interim reporting and when the change in estimate flows through, because I don't think we are there was a I don't have the comment number, but a comment in paper 2C that talks about whether or not you have to in effect restate interim periods when you update your estimates, and the answer is I think the wording in the staff analysis was a bit too strong in terms of you would never restate, previously reported. I think, we have lots of language in ISA that deals with that general issue. I think what you're saying is, having reported that period, things are subsequent changes
Yes.
In estimates, and I think we just have to think about the interaction of this requirement, which is written thinking maybe about annual reporting with interim reporting, and that's just a cleanup issue that follows on here.
Okay. I mean, the recommendation in paper 2C,
yeah.
and I agree that it's worded too
yeah.
broadly.
I agree with the recommendation, yeah. just not yeah. the expression of it.
Yeah, but that was meant to address exactly the problem
okay.
you're just talking about
okay.
here. So it was meant to say, you know, once you've had a reporting period and you've done your calculation and you've said this is a change in estimate and this is an experience
yeah.
adjustment and, you know, this is what I've released, you wouldn't go back and revisit all those calculations because of things that happened in a subsequent
right.
period.
And I just think that we have to think about that, particularly in light of the generic statement in IS 34 that the frequency of reporting should not affect.
And that's why we put the
yeah.
recommendation
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
You're going to have to yes. say notwithstanding or something
yeah.
so we don't
yeah.
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 Carol? So I think considered in isolation, I think this is absolutely the right decision. And I think for the reasons you explained, I think if we were enforcing a full-on application of this, essentially what you would have to do is require a daily update of your assumptions and then measure what your actual was against that daily outcome. What we do here is we essentially say with the CSM that we allocate CSM on the principle that the information that exists, that we now know exists at year end, that we found out about it here, in fact existed relative to that book at the beginning of the year. I think that, and we've heard a lot during the process, that these things don't change an awful lot, but I think that's a valid assumption given the fact that we're generally dealing with insurance risk matters, not with things like market changes and the like. So I think applying the allocation of the CSM to the best estimate we have available at the time that we're doing the allocation is correct. I think Tuck has a point. I don't think the point is necessarily to do with CSM. I think the point is to do with the fact that we have decided that an experience adjustment provides useful, relevant information for the understanding of the financial statements. I think that does then mean that we have some inconsistency in this process, but I think that inconsistency is only an issue in certain very specific and very less likely circumstances. I'm comfortable with that play out of where we get to this. And I think the necessity here is considering what the correct allocation is, the usefulness of the experience information.
Yes, I agree with Darrell, and maybe the inconsistency which I raised could happen in certain circumstances. Therefore, we would say that it is not very significant. However, having an inconsistency in the fundamental model, that is what I'm very happy with. So knowing that we have this inconsistency, but we assume this would not happen. That is what we are going to do. And as long as it is very transparent, so that our constituents can understand, then I can live with it.
I don't understand the inconsistency. Can you come a few more bars on?
Yes. Actually, what happens is when you recognize revenue, you have to release the amount of liability, which is as expected, which is written in B116, based on the assumption made in the beginning of the year. Then, when you calculate revenue, you, in essence, you, in the simple model, you add up the release amount of CSM on top of the released amount, which was calculated in as expected. But CSM itself is after adjustment. So we are adding up the something different. And then deduct the actual payment and then get the outcome. So in most cases, it doesn't really cause a big problem. But in specific circumstances, or maybe it could be many circumstances, it may concentrate the impact of change in the year you made a change a little bit too much. In the sense, it's a kind of double count, double counting the effect of the change in the revenue side plus CSM side. So in a sense, every impact goes on to the year of the change a little too much. So therefore, I don't think it's really correct mechanism. That is my point.
But Zach, I think that the inconsistency that you're describing really is driven by our desire to show experience adjustments as gains and losses in the period, and that's what causes this, what you were describing as the effect of double counting.
Yeah.
Is because we're taking them,
yeah,
the effect, their effect in the period in full, that means that, you know, to the extent that that effect actually is also part of, say, a change in assumptions that we're assuming happened at the beginning of the year, the experience adjustment in some cases picks up that effect for the current period, and then because of the way we're spreading the CSM, we end up picking up another effect for it in that same period. But that only happens when the experience adjustment in the year actually does reflect the sort of that period's share of the total change in assumptions. And that will just be coincidence. I mean, sometimes that will happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And but sometimes it won't.
My concern is it could, you know, exaggerate the change a little too much. So therefore, in most cases, it should be okay. But in certain circumstances, it could be a very odd outcome. So that is only my concern. But you know, knowing that, then if we estimate that this is not significant, and decide we should live with it, then I would be okay.
I mean, the effect could be significant if there's a large change in assumptions and the duration of the contracts is short, then there will be a significant difference in the amount of CSM that's released. But I don't agree there's any double counting here.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got revenue, expenses, profit.
Yeah.
We know what the expense is. It's maintenance expenses incurred in the period, and the other two have to work. So there can't be an imbalance. Either measure the revenue and the profit drops out, or you measure the profit and the revenue drops out. The three have to add up. So I don't see how we could end up with any double counting. Clearly there's a different answer, and we could go the opposite way of releasing CSM first. But I think that also has significant problems, not least that we fail to recognize the experience adjustments, which we've always said was an important part of the model.
That's the thing, because as Steve says, it does always have to add up in P&L. And so the question is the profit figure, what profit allocation do we want? And if we recognize experience adjustments in the period, you might argue that that means in some way we should make some adjustment for the fact that we've recognized those in the way that we allocate the CSM. But if we did that, we would sort of be negating the effects of recognizing them in P&L in the first place. So if given the board has always thought that experience adjustments be recognised in P&L. I mean, I think this is something, what you're describing is a consequence of that decision. And there's nothing we can do about it.
That capitulates. Okay. Question three. Capitulate away. That takes two bravery.
And then the final question in paper 2A is that in November we said that we wanted the treatment of the changes in cash flows that didn't relate to underlying items in the variable fee approach to mirror the way they were treated in the general model. Now we've changed the way they're going to be treated in the general model, so it would seem to be sensible to also change them in the variable fee approach, and that also for the variable fee approach has the advantage that these changes in estimates of future cash flows are now going to the contractual service margin, which is where basically just about everything goes under the variable fee approach. So it makes the variable fee approach much simpler than what we had decided in November as well. So the question is, do you agree that we should make that change to the variable fee approach to make it consistent with the general model and actually, to be honest, more consistent with the principles of the variable fee approach as well.
Agreed?
Agreed.
All in favour?
So now we move on to agenda paper 2B. In I4S, the unit of account is typically the individual contract. In November 2016, the board decided that the unit of account for measuring insurance contracts in IFRS 17 would rather be the group of contracts. This is discussed in paragraphs 4 to 5. One of the requirements that the board decided in November was to divide a portfolio into groups of contracts, meaning a group of contracts that are onerous at inception, a group of contracts not significantly likely to be onerous, and other contracts. There could be situations where law, there's a specific law or regulation that constrains the entity's ability to set pricing and benefits paid in a way that reflects the differing characteristics of the individual policyholders. In such cases, it could be that because of that effect, that an entity would need to divide a portfolio into more than one group of contracts, so two or more. The paper considers whether an exemption should be permitted in that specific narrow circumstances so that the entity could result in a single group in that particular circumstances. The staff recommend in the paper that if the exemption were to be provided, that the exemption is narrowly specified, i.e. that it applies only when there is a specific law or regulation that results in that effect of separate groups. That the exemption should not be extended by analogy to other regulatory affected transactions. And that if an entity uses that exemption, it should disclose that fact. The question for the board is on page 8. I'll now turn it over to the board for discussion.
It's a little weird to be leading off on insurance on something, but so be. As I was saying in the last one, I have a pretty high hurdle for making changes at this point in our process of finalizing, and so that made me start out saying, let's not do this, added to which introducing exceptions is, I think, something we should do very cautiously, and overall in this project, I feel that cross-subsidy or an intention to do cross-subsidy is something that is relevant and therefore useful information to users of financial statements, so I'd like to see it gross rather than happening behind the scenes and only seeing the net effect. Having said all this, in circumstances you lay out, I think it's a message that we've been hearing for a long time in the consultation about regulation, and I would do it as the staff has proposed, which is drawn very tightly and limited only to law regulation imposed groupings. The argument about it can be tough because there can be borders of jurisdictions and there'll be different requirements. That, to me, that's tough luck. I mean, when I was living in the States and I bought my auto insurance in New Jersey, I couldn't buy it in New York because that was a different market. You know, the jurisdictional borders matter, and I think we just have to accept that and have other people accept that. So I'm not wild about this, but I think a strong enough argument has been made to go back and do it based solely on the legal or regulatory requirement to basically make a decision about entering that a market beyond the basis of the combined, if you can't discriminate male versus female drivers or, you know, whatever the bandings are.
Yeah, we had a long I remember we had a long discussion about this the previous time that we considered it then.
Mm-hmm.
A split vote in which I proposed that present situation in the standard. I have since become convinced that this is something we probably need to do. I think that in practice, if there is such a legal requirement, a unisex requirement, for example, then the insurer is simply forced to look at the portfolio as a whole, to price it as a whole. I think that legitimizes looking at the two portfolios, one portfolio. I also think, you know, if we did not do this, it would be and arguments would fly around. The accountant makes it impossible for us to do this in a proper way. We would have a very difficult time explaining this. So all in all, I think under the very narrow circumstances that are described in this proposal, I think it's something I could live with. Amaro?
Well, after what you said and after Mary's conclusion, I guess I have not much to add. I started out as a little bit reactive to this. Consider, I think my reaction was an unconscious high hurdle to make changes at this time. And why is that? Because I believe that application of the principles could drive the grouping to a similar outcome as the exemption is proposed. But I do agree at this stage, and again, making reference to my first comment on the benefit of having the draft being, let's say, through review and learning and listening to the outcome of what the draft would generate. I think it's my position is to agree with staff because as the way it's drafted in paragraph 20 in page 10, as you propose, as initial drafting, just to help us, I think really the draft helped me quite significantly, and this was very helpful in making my final call to this. So I think it's appropriate to give this exemption. I think it's appropriate to provide these clarifications at inception, and I think will help greatly to apply consistently the model, but in this particular aspect that is grouping portfolio, that is very, very delicate.
Stephen?
So I agree very much with the staff recommendation on this. I've got a couple of questions more about how it's explained rather than the recommendation itself. So in paragraph 5, we talk about why we've gone to groups. And to my mind, what's in paragraph 5, that we make estimates that are valid on average for each contract in the group. I've always thought that wasn't really why we went to groups, because you can have on a probability weighted basis an individual contract, and then you can have for the group the same outcome, it's just the sum of the individual contracts. And you can do experience at the individual contract level. Some will have positive, some will have negative, and they'll offset, and then you get to the group. I always thought the reason why, reluctantly, I agreed to groups was because of operational issues and then the lapse problem that we had. So I was just wanted to flag that from the point of view of explanation in the future. And then another paragraph. Well, that was the lapse. And the other one is paragraph 11A. So the reason, so talking about the economic effect of regulation, and the phrase, there is no difference economically between an entity that chooses to price ignoring a factor and those who are required to ignore it. I think there is a difference economically, and that is you can't discriminate based upon the risk factor that's subject to regulation. So you can't refuse somebody insurance because male or female, but you could, for example, refuse insurance to young drivers. There's no regulation, at least in my knowledge, that says you have to offer the same price to young drivers and old drivers, but and therefore you could choose, if you wanted to, not to insure the young drivers. So it seems to me that there is an important economic difference for regulation, which is the requirement that you cannot discriminate between the two groups. And I think that is a differentiating factor that means that it is right to ignore the regulated risk factor when assessing the grouping. Can I ask one other question? So if we ignore, let's say it's the male-female split, of course that doesn't mean to say that an entity looking at a portfolio which is affected by regulation can all ignore all other risk factors. So I presume there would still be a need to segment the portfolio if necessary to take that into account, and therefore you could have part of that portfolio that was, for example, onerous. It doesn't give you a sort of carte blanche to just lump everything together and ignore it.
Yeah.
And we will make that very clear in the drafting, I hope.
Well, the drafting, it, as drafted here, was tried to make that clear, that it's only because regulation affects the pricing that you end up in these two, into these two or three groups. If there are other reasons in ending up into two or three groups, perhaps, as you said, there could be differences in pricing for other reasons that you've chosen to undertake, then yes. It's not a carte blanche, as you say. It's not automatic that if you have regulation for a specific group of contracts, automatically it's one particular, one combined group.
I was going to raise something similar, so can we make it more specific so we're all clear what we're talking about? So the scenario I was thinking about was where I have, I don't know, young and old drivers, and some are men and some are women.
Yeah.
So and I price them all the same. Now that's because of two reasons. One, because legislation in this instance says I can't differentiate between the men and the women. But I've made a conscious decision not to differentiate between young and old because I just chose to. So in that circumstance, what happens?
Well, you have to look, first of all, so you can, in its essence, ignore the male and female. But if the pricing for the differences in age causes the one to be onerous at the beginning or to be significantly more likely to be onerous, then yes, you would end up into two groups, perhaps based on that age.
That's good. I also had one other geeky point, which was just for drafting.
Sure.
When we talk about law or regulation, I presume what we mean is specific law or regulation. So we don't mean, for example, that if in a country there's a constitutional sort of obligation to treat all citizens equally, that that's a basis for saying I have law or regulation that somehow is a barrier. We're talking about something more specific than that.
Yes, that's correct. And we'll try to make it clear in the draft.
Well, I agree with the staff recommendation, and I agree with it because indeed I think it will provide more relevant information. And I think the outcome of recognizing this effect of regulation is very similar to what has already been acknowledged in IFRS 17 when mutualization exists because of the contract terms. So I think there it's the regulation that brings this economic interdependency between the categories that can't be escaped. So I think for the same reason that the mutualization requirements have been designed, this is very consistent with it. So I see it as an exception to the way the guidance has been defined, but I don't see it as a contradiction to previous decisions. And I think it's when we call something exception, I think we need to be cautious of not inducing that we are making an exception to a principle. I think that's important for the understanding of people, that it is not something that should not be done. I also wanted to mention that in contrast, in fact, with here, in paragraph 5, when we acknowledge why we have moved to groups instead of considering insurance contracts, I think, in fact, we acknowledge the fact that because of the insurance business, you need to have groups that have statistical validity to be meaningful. And that element, I feel, is not yet represented in the guidance that has been drafted. And maybe I would welcome that this condition.
I don't agree with that, because if I have a single insurance contract, for whatever reason, a satellite launch, I think the standard applies to it. I don't think you actually need a group to apply the standard. I mean, obviously, if you're managing an insurance business, it's pretty silly to just have one contract, you know, as a business. Statistically, you need the law of large numbers to successfully operate, but I think the standard itself can apply, should apply to an individual contract.
And we say it does. Yep. We say you can have groups of one contract if that contract is the only thing that is like it. In
the same way we would, for example, in IFRS 9 for expected losses, because the principle applies exactly the same.
It's a probability weighting of the expected scenarios, not an amalgam of lots of.
I mean, you're more likely to get significant positive and negative experience. You're guaranteed to get positive and negative experience when it's an individual contract, but the model itself would still apply.
Yes.
So you get better information if you have a large group. But that is about refining the information of what you're trying to get.
I'm sure you get better information because it still faithfully reflects the contract when it was issued, probability weighted cash flows, and then the outcome, better or worse than expected. When you have a group, the outcome is more likely to be similar to what was expected because of the law of large numbers, but it's still all relevant information.
I didn't want to suggest that the requirements would not have to apply in certain circumstances to individual contracts. I was intended to highlight that when we expect people to identify those sets of contracts, they can remain consistent with the way they have approached their pricing policy in terms of reacting to objectives of profitability and under the pressure of competition. When they do that, to have a stable, pricing and results, they need this statistical validity. And if we have, if we have a knowledge that we need to take into account the characteristics of the insurance business in those groups, I think it should be reflected somewhere.
I don't think that we have our principle isn't that you have to have statistically valid groups that are large enough to be statistically valid. The size of the group depends entirely on, you know, whether they fall into the bucket of being onerous or the resilient bucket or the norm, and the size is just what it is.
I think this is one of maybe the areas where we commonly kind of, or perhaps where we need to be careful in how we actually talk about it. So when we talk about the requirement and regulatory requirement that you have a statistically significant group, what the idea behind that is, you actually determine the estimates. That is in determining the best estimate liability for a regulatory space. The requirements from our perspective in terms of calculating fulfillment cash flows are not dissimilar from that. What we'd say is that you need to be using the best information you have available to determine fulfillment cash flows. Because fulfillment cash flows are not necessarily divided in exactly the same way into the same groups that we require for performance measurement, I think you can, in fact, use the same size groups for regulatory reporting and for the determination of your fulfillment cash flows. And so I think if you are following the requirement that you need to use a reliable measure for, I think many entities will conclude that they will use or they will calculate their fulfillment cash flows based on the same determination that they're using for their regulatory-based estimates process. I think we've got the second element which comes in, which is perhaps the thing that does not exist in a, which is performance reporting. Performance reporting requires us to consider, because of the fact that we are measuring profitability over time and not measuring profitability at inception, performance reporting essentially says we have to think a little bit differently about how we determine when profits occur, how we determine when losses occur. And that delay in recognizing profits, and I think you used the word earlier, Sue, asymmetric,
the asymmetric requirement that you recognize a loss immediately, that you recognize a profit over time, places a much greater emphasis for the determination of CSM on the level of granularity of the groups that you determine. And I think it's that difference that we're talking about here. But I think your point about the fact that regulatory requires a statistically valid size works equally well for fulfillment cash flows, and I can see many entities doing that. I think at the same time, though, to come back to Steve's example, I think we would not want you not to measure a single contract that just doesn't group with anything else. You need to do it, and in that circumstance, you may argue that even though you do not have a statistically significant size, there is still the need to measure that contract. So to Anne's point, I think even if I am dividing my contracts into three, my onerous, my not onerous, etc., that doesn't mean that I can't continue to calculate my fulfillment cash flow at the higher level, and all I then have to do is allocate the effect of that into the different CSM buckets.
So but make a distinction between fulfillment cash flows and CSM, just so that everybody understands.
Absolutely. I think it is important, and we sometimes forget that we've got a model that is very similar in the determination of fulfillment cash flow to what applies in the regulatory regime, and I suspect a lot of insurers will lend from their experience with applying solvency to another in determining the fulfillment cash flows. But CSM is distinctly different, and that's because solvency II and other regulatory regimes don't worry about performance. They worry about absolute measurement.
Yeah.
The other point I just wanted to make was I am a little bit concerned about equating mutualization to regulatory. I think a mutualized environment, what I'm thinking about is contractual relationships I have with existing customers. A contractual relationship that requires me, under certain circumstances, to move cash around. In the regulatory space, I'm thinking before I even have that contractual relationship. In other words, I could look at a regulatory environment and say, I expect that I will write a certain amount of female business that will offset my male business. There is no contractual relationship. If I don't write enough male business, tough, I'm still stuck with my, or I don't write enough female business, I'm still stuck with the consequences of what I've done. So although I think there are some similarities, and I think we can perhaps think about doing it, I've been a little bit concerned about making it or weighting them too closely together.
Very well.
Firstly, I fully agree with Tao's proposal. Next, you know, as I explained several times, I personally do feel, you know, we are too generous to provide too much detailed guidance in three major areas: portfolio, recognition of changes, and the allocation of CSM. On the one hand, I can say it is useful, it's because enhanced clarity and enhanced consistency. But the problem is, you know, compared to other standards in depreciation revenue, I do feel in other standards we not provide so many guidance on allocations on, you know, portfolio determination. So I still worry in the future people will come back again, give us different scenarios, then ask us whether it is in line or not, or whether you should give us much more, you know, exceptions or other kind of clarities or guidance. Tapas, your example is a typical, and the mutualization is another example. And I will not challenge you, not necessarily to answer. If mutualization and the regulatory environment, some of mutualization arrangement is as a because of regulatory, law or regulation required to do so, what kind of consequence will be. No need to answer. my question, I want to get a clarity. One thing. I would not, you know, challenge the result. The based on the staff proposal, self-regulatory practice will not be subject to this exemption. Yeah, I will agree. But I can see the consequence for Europe. It will be totally different to other countries. You know, if you put China versus Europe as a opposite examples, and China is a centralized country, you know, laws, regulations may be applied nationwide. So therefore, you know, if you know, China can get such exemption, it will be national, you know, favor. But think about the, in Europe, so many, you know, sovereign country, you know. Let's assume Belgium, France, and, you know, Netherlands, or other neighbor countries are all get exempted. A tiny country called the Luxembourg cannot, you know, have such a law. Then
Luxembourg has all the exemptions in the world.
Here's also exemption. Yeah. Okay. Another example. You know, but they, because surrounding countries, the surrounding country all have such kind of law. They all have such kind, got such kind of exemption. But a particular country with, you know, within it cannot get, you know.
But isn't that a difference in that case? In your example, Luxembourg is indeed different to those other jurisdictions.
Yeah, I will not challenge it, but I just want to, you know, this is a real consequence for Europe.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think most of this kind of regulation is probably Europe and West.
But if it wasn't, then that would be.
But Europe is particularly because if you go to other countries, they are basically sovereign countries. No. Europe is a union at the same time.
No, I mean, I think in the United States you get a lot of variation state to state on some of these issues, so that it's going to, New Jersey versus New York versus Connecticut will have different requirements on some things like this. So it's going to bite in situations like that too. That's life. Regulation is has real economic effects.
And there's a wide range in different regulations around health insurance contracts, for example, in different parts of the world. So it's not a European.
I don't want to challenge it, but I just want.
I think
it's
just
this
pointing
is
out
the consequences.
Yes, yes.
Consequences.
Neighboring states with different regulations.
Yep.
Yeah. They have different regulations, different consequences. Yep.
Okay.
So coming to vote on the staff question. So the principle in the standard is to divide a portfolio into groupings based on onerous. Staff are proposing if you make an exemption, that the exemption be provided in the narrow circumstances specified in on page 8, and with the accompanying disclosures and the fact that's limited.
Yes, that's the question. Yeah.
Yes.
Do we agree?
Oh, do you agree?
all in favour. Oh, sorry. Apart from one.
Paper.
11
I'm
in favor, one
consensus
in
favor.
One.
Okay.
Yes, good morning. Can you please move on to Agenda Paper 2C? Actually, we lost Agenda Paper. In December 2016, the Board conducted an external editorial review of the draft of IFRS 17. The objective of external editorial review was twofold. Namely, it was to confirm whether there weren't any inconsistencies within the standards and with other standards, and also to assess whether the draft clearly describes the board's decisions. At the same time as the external editorial review was conducted, the board conducted its internal review of the draft standard. In general, the comments received from both reviewers were relatively fewer than in the previous review we conducted in the summer. We noted that there were few areas of overlap occurring, suggesting that reviewers beginning to focus on specific details rather than identifying areas where the standard caused problems. This paper summarizes the key comments raised in the review and the staff responses to these comments, divided into two tables. Table A lists the issues that we proposed to amend the draft in response to the comments we received, and table B that lists the areas that we proposed to clarify. In addition, we also received comments about issues the commentators disagreed with the board's decisions. We have listed the main issues and the reasons for the board's position. I would like to clarify three points in the paper before I ask you for your comments on it. The first is on point B6 that starts on page 6 and 17. We're proposing that the eligibility criteria for the premium allocation approach is to be formed at the group level, and that the eligibility criteria the board previously decided on will remain the same. The second is on point B9, that starts on page 21. There, the reference in paragraph C16, C4, to the ratio of the mounds in C16, C1 and C16, C2 should instead refer to a comparison of the remaining coverage units to the total coverage units of the groups of contracts. And just the last point is on point B14, that starts on page 23, where we propose that no separate disclosures are required for investment contracts with discretionary participation features. So just three clarifying points on the paper 2C. And then I'd like to turn it to you for any specific questions or comments you have on the paper.
Any question or what?
Any question?
Any question? A and B and C?
Yes.
All right. Yep. Okay, I would like.
Which item number?
Oh, yes. I would like to make a comment on D7 first, and then later A3. So I was a bit surprised with the B7 suggestion. I appreciate you try to clarify the definition of variable fee approach. However, when I read the actual drafting, which is on page 37, B105, it says the variable fee approach, that insurance contracts with direct participation features are contracts that are substantially investment management service contracts. And if it's really substantially investment service contract, then why don't you go to IFRS 15? Because, you know, if it's a service contract, you should follow IFRS 15 rather than IFRS 17. Because IFRS 17 says we are dealing with a contract with a significant insurance risk. And if you have a significant insurance risk, then how come you say it's a simple service contract? So therefore, my fear is there are lots of, you know, kind of what we call fake insurance contracts, which basically pure service management, but you know, slice of insurance and the quality insurance. But that is not what we are talking about as a variable fee approach. And actually, this three condition, which was described in B102. Was a very, you know, dedicated wording, which we spend a lot of time to discuss. And then all of a sudden, if we put such an overarching wording, that will jeopardize everything we discuss when we make these three standards. And the other question is, in the B102, it talks about the underlined items. So say for example B102A is the contractual term specified by the policyholders participant in the share of clearly identified pool of underlying items. And the underlying item is not necessarily investment. It contains a variety of things, insurance as well, and including insurance risk. So if we say it's a just a service contract, management contract, substantially the same, it will jeopardize the meaning of B102. So I think we should delete this sentence.
The intention of adding in the substantially investment management or investment related service contracts was to help people interpret the conditions that are set out in B102, in particular B102A and B and C, so that they could understand better what we were trying to get at when we said substantial. We did not intend that it would be another criteria that you had to meet in addition to A, B and C in B102. So we will, you know, in drafting, we can change the way it's worded to make it clear that if you meet B102, A, B, and C, then you are in the scope of the variable fee approach, and that's it. There's nothing more to be done. We think we do need something that will explain or give people the context in which to think about whether there's a substantial share of the things in B and C. And that's what this phrase was meant to do. So, yes, the contract has to have significant insurance risk, or it wouldn't be in the scope of IFRS 17. But it also, while having significant insurance risk, has to be something that is, you know, like an investment related.
Yeah. In most cases,
what we were trying to get at.
In most cases, it's investment related. But it depends. Different countries have a different type of insurance. And
but the investment could be anything. And we do say that the underlying items can be...
That's the point. The underlying item is not necessarily investment.
Actually, I think what we're doing with the variable fee approach is we're looking at contracts where the underlying items, whatever they may not be financial assets or what you might traditionally think of as investment assets, but the substance of what they're doing in that contract is behaving as if they were related to investment. And that's what we're trying to capture here.
Basically, as if you invested into an insurance business.
Investment. Insurance.
You've chosen to invest in a...
That's exactly the point. Because this is within the insurance contract, and the investing insurance isn't really within the scope.
Exactly.
However, if you overlay that this is investment service management, then people have different idea what the investment service management is all about. In most cases, say for example, in my jurisdiction, if it's a substantially investment management service, then people think investment service management is to invest in the equity or something, and just take the money and invest and get the fee. Only that. It doesn't imply that you are doing insurance business. So the idea of investment management service is different. Different decisions and different notions. So my concern is overarching wording, to put the overarching wording at this late stage would really jeopardize what we have done so far. But that is my concern.
So I think Tak's raising two points, right? One is an understanding of what that term means, which we need to be clear about. The second is making sure we don't create some sort of conflict between the criteria that get you into the scope, that it is those three things that matter.
Okay. So I'll take into consideration. Greg Wong.
Two items, A9 and 10.
Oh, okay.
Another one later, maybe.
Okay,
thank you. The other one is A3, the mutualization. And I really appreciate what you have done. And I read B67 to 71 over and over again.
I hope you were lying in bed.
And we couldn't reach how we can do it, because the many constituents have lots of concern. To what extent they have to track the real cash flow? So to follow the cash flow very accurately, group by group, accurately, precisely, would create a lot of burden. And there are many constituents who is fully mutualized, and that basically, all in all, they can mutualize within certain groups. Then they cannot feel that doing tracking all the detail of cash flow doesn't really make sense. So what they would like to do is, as long as they are not onerous as a mutualized group, they can amortize the CSM based on their group and combine it later on internally, and they check it whether it meets the B68 or not. And so I just want you to make sure that if it's a fully mutualized, and then as long as you can provide some evidence that you are satisfied with B68, then the mechanism they want to introduce internally is up to the entity. Is my understanding correct?
That's true. If contracts were completely fully mutualized, then it is likely, I think, that you'd get the same answer.
Yeah.
They'd have to be variable fee type approaches, otherwise there would be issues to do with discount rates under the general model. But if they're fully mutualized, they're going to be variable fee approach contracts. So I think that's true, and we were going to explain in the basis that is what we expect to happen.
Okay.
We don't want to put anything in the standard because, you know, it's always true with standards. If you can get to the answer that the standard requires, that's what you have to do. It doesn't matter how you do it. You just have to get to the answer that the standard requires. So it would be odd to put something in that said that for one particular thing and not for anything else. But we are planning to put words in the basis explanation of how we think annual groups work in the context of fully mutualized contracts. I think we're not sure how common fully mutualized contracts will be.
Mary?
Well,
Wakewell. Oh,
Wakewell. A9, A10. If we look at the suggestions, first, I feel it's okay. But read it carefully, I feel, you know, just as Mary said, the wording is too strong.
Yeah, it is. We need
both
to
of them.
It. Yeah.
I have a general views on any standards related to other standards. We have a particular standards on other areas. We have to make sure the consistency among them. In particular, for example, interim standards, you know, standards on tax, and segmental reporting, foreign currency. And these two examples, for example, the first example relates to the interim standards and also related to standards on changes in accounting error and policy. And the second one relates to revenue and the tax standards. And in terms of the second one, I discussed with the revenue staff. And from beginning, I tried to distinguish between, you know, agent and principal. And the staff said, no, we were not, you know, purely agent principal. And then whether it can be labeled sales based or transaction based, and staff say the Weibo, please wait a minute. There are some, you know, differences. You know, please check with the revenue staff if necessary. Mm-hmm. The second one, whether we should write in such exclusive at all. It may be not.
Mary?
The ones I was going to pick on are A3 and A7. I think in respect of A3, a lot of Fox's comments covered what I wanted to raise. I mean, again, in agreement with the staff recommendations, not suggesting going a different way in dealing with that comment, I think your observation about the word mutualization is used by many people to mean different things is why it's important that the drafting that you had in the appendix talks about contractual, but I think we may need to make clear the distinction between when this notion, the unspoken word, the M word, affects thing. It is a consideration in accounting for the contracts and when it's not, and it's the point about the policy requires versus its management intent to do something even in the absence, you know, of a requirement to do so, and the other is making the distinction between impacting the cash flows and impacting the grouping. because I think the if you look at A3, what the staff is explaining is when it's part of the terms of the contract, it's reflected in the estimation and re-estimation of the present value of future cash flows, but it's not a basis for overriding groups of the general grouping requirements. And I think making that clear is important. How it comes into play. So it's agreement, but those are the things that struck me. And then on A7, and this is about the reassessing the contract boundary at each reporting period. That seemed like a huge hurdle when I first thought about it, but then I realized that in most cases the contract boundary changes in your expectations about the contract are going to feed into your present value of fulfillment of future cash flows. And so I think it's probably more making the observation about the interaction of assumptions about contract boundary with qualifying for the premium allocation approach. And that's it's a communication point rather than a requirement point, because I would hate somebody to go away and say, oh my word, they've just confirmed a huge new requirement, which it isn't a new requirement. You're going to have to do changes in estimates in your contract boundary, which are things like, will I keep my, will I, as a policyholder, renew for as many years as was expected or not? As you get more information or have experience adjustments, it can flow into your future cash flows.
Sue?
A couple of things more on the nature of drafting points, but I'm raising them just because I think they might help with messaging for people as well. The first one's in relation to B8 and this use of the term contractual terms. So we talk about the fact that you need to consider all substantive rights and obligations in contract law or regulation, but then we go on and say a contract is the agreement between two people. I think that if I was reading this and applying the standard, I'd feel comforted to have explicit confirmation that when we use the word contractual, we mean including the law and regulation, etc., not just the words in the contract. I think that's what we mean, and I think being explicit might make people feel happier. And another drafting suggestion is a lot of people who have contacted me seem to have issues around an impression that we're hunting for individual onerous contracts. And one of the things I think that maybe we could do, and I'm referring now to the revised drafting in the appendix as opposed to anything in your list, is in paragraph 18, where we talk about the use of reasonable and supportable information. And we focus specifically on what that means for contracts that are onerous at initial recognition. To me, the same idea applies for all of the decisions you're making for grouping in paragraph 17. So I think by emphasising onerous here, we're making people think we're particularly hunting onerous contracts. And I think if 18 was expanded for all of that grouping decision, maybe that.
Stephen.
So C8 is the one I wanted to ask about. So this is the allocation of the CSM, and some commentators have been disagreeing with the prior decision, suggesting that if we allocate straight line and there's a significant investment management service, that in some way that is going to be advancing the recognition of profit. And I think, and we had a long discussion about this, and we had different views. We've come to a decision, I fully accept the decision, but I think it's very important that we explain this clearly as best we can. And to my mind, the model would have been so much simpler had we recognized the profit at the beginning as was proposed in the original discussion paper. To my mind, we are deferring that what would be a sort of a more correct recognition on a current value basis. And also, I think that the desire to have later recognition is more following the cash flow. So if you're doing an account charge type deduction, then the account charges are going to be back-end loaded. And we've said in the past that we don't want to follow the cash flow, that we want to try and recognize it on the basis of service provided. I mean, it's a difficult area, and I'm just trying to find a way of providing a more full explanation for something that I know is going to be questioned. I've got one more, and that is also paragraph 18 in the drafting. So I've been having some conversations with people on this, and about whether this paragraph in some way automatically pushes you to individual contracts. So shall determine which contracts are onerous at initial recognition. So clearly at initial recognition, you know that ultimately some contracts are going to prove to be duds and not so good. So that circumstances will change, experience will happen, and there'll be some contracts you'll lose money on and some contracts that you won't lose money on. And that I think some people have been interpreting this as, well, you've got to, because you know you're going to lose money on some contracts, doesn't that automatically mean that you've got something onerous at initial recognition? And I don't believe that is the interpretation of 18 that's correct, that you need to look at 18 as at the initial recognition, based upon the information available at initial recognition, which is that the contracts at that time are the same,
yes,
similar enough to be in the same group,
yes,
and on a probability-weighted basis, none of them are onerous.
Yes.
Later on, you might have experience that,
yes,
results in some making a loss, but then that's the subsequent accounting kicking in, changes,
yep,
in estimates, experience adjustments, and the like. But I think some people are reacting to the that in the sets are either all onerous or all not onerous. And that drafting is kind of, well, I can't say they're all not onerous because I know that some are going to turn out to be bad, and therefore it pushes you into the individual contracts.
Okay. So this is similar to the point that we discussed in the earlier paper, I think, about probability weighting. So to take a very simple example, if you have 100 identical houses with fire insurance, you know there's only one fire. What we mean is that each contract has a 1% chance of a fire, and so each bears 1% of the expected claim. Not that one is onerous and 99 are profitable.
Yep.
And it's that distinction that we're trying to, that you're trying to articulate, isn't it?
And the explanation about onerousness is fully contained within the standard, isn't it? We don't have to somehow cross-refer to IS-37.
No, it's onerous in the context of IFRS 17 is defined in IFRS 17 in the section on onerous contracts, groups of contracts, and that explains what onerous means on initial recognition and then how it can arise later on subsequent measures as well. So it's all contained within IFRS 17.
Not affected by the individual contract wording in 37?
No.
Any more questions? Nope.
So can we say, ask the board whether they agree with the way we have proposed to resolve the issues that we've identified in this paper, subject to the drafting changes that we've discussed in the paper?
That must be the case. Yeah.
All in favour?
Okay.